Session number 25054, Reel 6.
Derek Plummer, Reel 6.
G pass out, and I went back into the laundry, and the bloke who'd taken our order, and I said, "Have you got one of the spare one of those?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Can I take it?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "What about fuel?" He said, "Much as you like, down there on pumps." Got a key off a hook and gave me the key, and we kept that Jeep. My God, we had opposition. Everybody wanted it. We were the only flotilla there that had transport. Masheter, the petty officer, kept the key, and I said, "Never, never give it to anyone, Masheter. That's ours." Then boats began to appear. And also a new training officer appeared up. It's a vast camp. I can't tell. I think the wardroom could have housed, could have sat 200 people, officers down. And there were about 20 of us. And
so can I just ask you one or two questions? We'll continue chronologically. So you were now, what rank were you?
Sub-lieutenant. I was a confirmed sub-lieutenant. Now, this is my first job as a sub-lieutenant. Yeah.
And the first time you've actually been in command.
Yes.
Of quite a lot of men.
Well.
How did that feel? When you're suddenly in charge.
Well, I was estranged to it, as they were, I think, so I didn't feel the least bit strange. It was very good. I had an excellent petty officer.
Yeah. What sort of men were these? I mean, you said combined ops. Did they have different talents?
Or no talents at all, I think. They were most useless people. They were mostly there were no regular sailors at all. They're all peacetime hostilities only, we called them HOs, hostilities. They were just there for the war. They were from all walks of life. They were full of fun. They knew nothing about combined operations any more than I did.
And were they from the Navy then?
All Navy. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
All Naval Rangers.
They'd seen some sort of service?
Some of them, but most of them were so young they hadn't seen very much. Really? Yes, very young.
Okay.
Only the petty officer Mashed and I had four leading seamen. They'd been at sea in the war, and so they knew a bit about it.
Yeah.
The rest were able seamen, brand new. Right. And the boats arrived. And we got a training officer arrived one day, and he sent for me, and he said, "Plummer, you've got a flotilla, you've got no boats, you're my assistant." I said, "All right, sir." And this man was Commander Ryder, R.E.D. Ryder, known as Red Ryder, who got a Victoria Cross at San Jose. He was the San Jose hero. He had a very soft voice, and I didn't think he could speak louder than a whisper until the first time we walked to the end of a jetty, and he said, "What time are these people supposed to be away in boats? So they're exercising in their empty in their landing craft." I said, "They should be away at 7 o'clock, sir." And so he went right to the edge and looked down, and there was a young Lieutenant RMVR down there. He said, "What time are you away?" I don't know what's his name, and I told him. He said, "What time are you away, sir?" He said, 7 o'clock, sir." And he screamed. It was then about 7:03. "What the hell are you doing there at 3? And I realised that Red Ryder had two sides. He was, but very, very efficient. And nothing would escape. Nothing at all.
Mm-hmm. And what did he look like?
Short. Extraordinarily fit man. Looked as if he was walking quietly, but always in a hurry. In himself, although he didn't rush around, he was always ahead of himself in his thoughts and his actions. He couldn't get to anywhere quick enough, but he never ran or anything like that. And then suddenly my craft arrived, and I found I had 12 LCA brackets P, landing craft assault, P for personnel, and each one of them carried 35 soldiers when we got some soldiers. And my flotilla was 12. And we did endless exercises in and out of lochs in Scotland, trying to get to a beach, a particular place on a chart, going by night, by sea, going ashore by day and camouflaging yourself, and then setting off next, so that you could get from here to there without being seen. There were umpires along. If they saw you, you lost points. Well, it was, I can't tell you what a waste of time it was. And eventually, the big ships started to arrive, big luxury liners converted for war. No lifeboats, only special davits fitted for taking assault craft. I'm not going to. And the big ships arrived. Each ship had one army officer on board called the commandant. He was usually a retired colonel. And nothing else service-wise at all. They were just merchant ships, requisitioned, slightly converted, and ready to take troops out to wherever we were going. We didn't know. I'd done plenty of exercises in two Polish ships. One was called Batory, and the other Sobieski. I've got some drawings there of both of them. And I thought they were luxury ships, and I thought at last this is going to be a comfortable war. And but when it came to the crunch and we started getting troops, I was in the worst ship of the lot there. It was a Belgian ship in terrible condition with a dreadful crew. It's called Leopoldville. And the Belgians are not the best at cleanliness. And a dirty ship is usually a pretty badly run ship and an unhappy ship. And I, the whole way out into the Mediterranean, I slept on the upper deck. I was far too frightened of being torpedoed because I knew any hit there, the ship would just gone down. So not only did the ships arrive, but my, the 2 days after that, I got on my landing craft, hoisted up like boats, and I found I had a 13th. They gave me a 13th boat, and this one was an LCA, instead of brackets P personnel, was brackets G for guns. And I got with it a Marine sergeant and three ordinary Marines and a subaltern, a Marine subaltern, who I don't think could read or write, but he was a Marine subaltern. And this boat was a gunnery boat. And what they'd done, they'd taken, you know, the bombers, RAF bombers, the guns that they had slung underneath the Lancasters and things like that was a bolt and pawl machine gun in a turret. Well, they'd taken one of those and put it in this landing craft, and he was meant to shoot at things when we were landing our troops. He knew how to shoot the gun quite well anyway. So we had 13, which I think was unlucky. And the day arrived, only 2 days after we'd been in Leopoldville, my troops started to arrive, and I found I was taking the PPCLI, which stands for Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry, Canadians. They knew nothing about sea, so I offered my 50 men, whatever they were, to the commandant, and said, use these as porters, guides, anything, because they've got nothing else to do. So I didn't see my troops for a couple of days. They were my sailors. They were just helping the troops all the time.
So did you have an idea what combined ops was going to be?
Nothing. No idea at all. We didn't know where we were going or why. Absolutely nothing.
So you were going to go on board the Leopoldville?
Yes, we lived, and I was now permanently in Liverpool. Everybody was now taken from Roseneath, and they were now in ships. Roseneath was empty. We sailed on whatever day it was, and no one was allowed to open the orders until we, I think it was 36 hours before we could open the sealed orders, which were held by the commandant. He then called a meeting of myself, as the most junior one there, but I was the flotilla officer, and the colonel, and his, whatever the colonel has is his number two, and one other very, very small part five of us. We got the envelopes out, and he said, okay, you can open them now, and we opened it. And it was full of photographs of the beaches, and we found we were going to Sicily, and masses of instructions, and we then asked, you know, when can we tell the troops? He said, tomorrow. And so I told my blokes the next day. I studied them, the plans, the whole idea of what we were going to do, and the beaches particularly, and there was one main trouble on my beach, and that was there was a false beach. And so the main beach, with no false beach, you went straight up. The false beach meant you've got to judge your timing, because it dried out at low water, and quite a lot of the 6 hours of the tide it was exposed, so you couldn't get them over. And if you couldn't get them over, you had to put the troops in the water, and they had to go through 150 yards of water, which was bad. So everything hinged on the timing. It was a sort of window when it was clear, the rest. So I got it all absolutely in mind, so I enjoyed the trip out.
Can I just ask you, what training had you done? I mean, you were going to be taking all these troops onto the beach,
yes,
basically.
Yes.
What training had you actually done in beach
nothing.
Landings?
Nothing at all. Not
okay. Well, I must have missed that. Yeah.
No. We spent all our time, as I say, in the lochs of Scotland, trying to avoid being seen. Nothing to do with this at all. It's a waste of time. Everything's a waste of time. I forgot what I was going to say. When we got to Sicily, of course, the weather broke, and it was very much too rough. And it's quite a difficult thing to drop a heavy boat with 35 soldiers and a crew of three into the water. You have a thing, a thing you pull, and both hooks either end of the thing slip together, and she goes in the water. You've got to time it. If it's on the top of a wave, you can break the thing. If it's on the bottom of a wave, you do this. You've got to get it just right. Normally it's easy, but it was very rough, and it blew up, and of course everyone was being seasick.
So you've gone on HMS Leopoldville.
No, not HMS. It wasn't Her Majesty's ship. It was a Belgian ship. SS, steamship Leopoldville.
Right, and you've gone on that.
And we're now in the Mediterranean.
Into the Mediterranean.
Yes, yeah. And we're coming to Sicily.
And this is when the day of the invasion.
Yes, and the huge, massive.
So you were on the ship in the Mediterranean.
Yes.
Had you any idea what sort of scale of invasion this was? Who else was taking part in this?
No, I didn't know the... I knew when I was landing a battalion of Canadians, and all the other ships had... I think we did know the other ships, the makeup of the soldiers of the other ships. And, of course, there were a lot of troops coming out from North Africa. But I should have told you, when this format... after the subs course is when I was put into... combined operations. It was a guaranteed 6 months, and the total number was split in two. Half went up to Scotland, the other half went out to the Mediterranean and trained in Alexandria. And so a lot of friends of my friends were out there. They had the best time, better weather. And these two were timed to meet each other at exactly the right time off Sicily. They bounced around all night. Finally, we reached the place where the captain assured me that I was in the right spot. I was on the bridge with him. I said, okay, and I can take this course. He said, you're absolutely right. I rushed down to my boat. We all got in, and my number two and myself had special binoculars and to see during the night, British submarines had laid marker buoys for each flotilla. And each marker buoy had a different sequence of flashing. So you knew yours the moment you saw it. And we set sail, and I got the course and my little magnetic compass there, and we went straight, and I got the bloke's astern of me so I could find it. I brought my number two up with me alongside, and we scanned, and we couldn't find that bloody buoy. And I kept on moving further and further west because I thought we were being set down to the east. And... we must have gone miles. It seemed because time was being wasted. We wanted to get. Eventually, we found it. We both saw it at the same time. I got the Martin line ahead, and we turned and went straight into the beach. We must have wasted at least half an hour, probably more. I never worked it out.
Did the other boats find their marker buoys?
Oh, the others were okay. All the other flotillas, I think, were okay. We were wrong, and. We got to where I thought the false beach was, and we all got over except one. My thing with the colonel, we stuck on absolutely solid. We hit. We tried putting the troops forward, putting them off, jumping up and down, and I said to the colonel, I honestly think so. There's only one thing, walk. He said, I think so. He said, and we dropped the ramp. It was the little ramp in front, and 33 soldiers. Well, the colonel waited till the end with his aide, and he turned around and shook my hands. He said, thank you, plumber. I never thought it'd be anything like this. And I said, believe me, sir, I hadn't either. And for that, they went in, and most of them, because the water was up to here. Yeah. The rifles up there. The poor sods. And all the rest had landed.
Can I just ask you, what was the scene like as you came into the beach? This is in the dark, is it?
It was getting light now. It should have been dark.
Yes. And we were. And what could you see? And what could
I could see a lot of beach, nothing behind the beach at all. I couldn't see any hills or anything like that. It was too dark. But the sand was high, large sand dunes up, and that was about all. Spread for miles. And the Germans were somewhere, were firing, and of course, once we stuck, they started firing at us. It was sporadic, and it wasn't heavy. It was automatic weapons and things like that, and. When we'd finally got rid of our troops, who were swimming ashore, walking, how they fight a battle after that, I don't know. And they landed, and they did very well indeed, the Canadians. But we were stuck. And my bowman, I had a coxswain, a stoker who did the engine, and a bowman who was up forward there. And he was trying to sort of punt, get out with a boat on, trying to push. Now we were empty. He thought he could get the boat off. And while he was bending over backwards, his backside to the enemy, He was hit, badly damaged in the back of his spine. And we had got first aid stuff. We had morphia in a tiny little tube, like a watercolor tube, with a sort of thing you took off. And no one told me where to stick this thing. And so I stuck it in his backside, where nearest to the wound, which was awful, and squeezed, and it had no effect at all. So I went the other side with the second one. I thought, I don't want to overdose him and kill him. Eventually he quieted down. And by then, all the troops had landed, and my number two had managed to get his boat back. Obviously, the beach was like that. It wasn't like this everywhere, else everyone would have stuck. But he'd got back, and he came around to me. He said, shall I tear you off? I said, no, you leave me here. I'll wait till you come in next time. He had to go back for a second helping. And I said, you'll take this poor so-and-so. We got him into the thing. He went straight to a hospital ship, and he survived. So that was good. And the second wave came out, by which time my boat had been smashed. It wasn't worth it. I left it, and we waded ashore, all my little crew, and we climbed up on the beach. And we found that behind the beach there was acres and acres and acres of tomatoes. So we each grabbed a handful of tomatoes, and we sat and watched the war as if it was television, eating lovely warm tomatoes in the early morning sunshine. It wasn't a war at all. It was great fun.
What could you see? How much opposition was there?
Very soon overcome there. It was only a few miles west of Catania. And we couldn't see Catania, but the opposition was really rather feeble. We were terribly unlucky to be hit. I don't think anybody else was hit. It was wonderful to watch. It was a great armada out there all unloading. And as soon as we got rid of everyone, we turned and went to Alexandria, and through the canal and down to the Great Bitter Lakes, and then to Port Tewfik. That's the port. On Leopoldville. And I had been assured that 6 months was guaranteed we'd be back in general service. And there were four ships together, and I can't remember the others, but I remember six ships, sorry. And each one had a sub-lieutenant of my term, all wanting to get back. Luckily, one of the ships was slightly damaged, the merchantman, and at Port Tewfik, about 3 miles out from the little tiny town, the Egyptian town, we anchored, thank God. And I managed to get a boat. I think she came out to probably a pilot vessel or something. And I said, will you take me ashore? I went to see the captain and said, you know, if you sail without me, do you mind? He said, no. He was being a Belgian. And I got to Tewfik, and I walked miles and miles in blazing heat trying to find a telephone. And it was sort of a waterfront, no one there at all, no traffic. And finally I saw a hut, which was something to do with the pilots there. So I climbed out, and they spoke English. I said, have you got a telephone? He said, telephone. I said, will you please, you speaking the language, get me through to the naval headquarters in Alexandria? No problem. Got through, marvellous. Not like English telephones, and I asked for the Admiral's secretary, he was a commander, and I told him the story. I said, there are six of us here, we haven't got a watch scheme certificate yet, we should have, we've wasted 6 months in command operations, we promised to be back in England, they're going to take us out, next stop, Bombay. Leave it to me, he said, I'll see the Admiral, and I'll get a signal off if he agrees. By the time I got back to the ship, a signal had arrived saying all six sub-lieutenants were to be picked up.
Was that Admiral Tennant?
No, it was Admiral CNC Levant. Now, what was his name? Began with a U. Now, not many. He was the only Admiral I ever knew who was promoted from the lower deck.
Oh, right.
Which is quite... P.K. Enright. P.K. Enright. He made the signal, and before this little convoy left for Bombay, we somehow managed to get in a boat and got all our luggage on board. I went round collecting each one in turn. We went back to Tewfik. Naval transport had then arrived, a lorry, which we went from there up to the Great Bitter Lakes, where there was a huge camp, military camp, and we were put into under canvas there until transport was available. Eventually we ended up in Alexandria. And we went straight to the naval barracks there, and we each got a cabin, six of us. And we agreed that one of us would always stay in, the others could go off and do what they pleased, one would be the spokesman. thank God, a signal arrived saying that from just the local signal in Alexandria, saying the two subtenants were to go back in HMS Circassia, not a warship, which was the flagship of the BI, Bibby Line. And I wanted to be one of those, thank God I was there. So I wrote a signal, it was about midnight, telling a bloke called Mowins, Peter Mowins, who was next to it, that he and I would be, a signal to come say he and I were wanted to go in Circassia. The other four I wrote in the same note, put on their doors, said goodbye to them on the note, never saw them again. And we went down early in the morning, we joined Circassia, which was Commodore Bone, who wrote a book, one of the very first penguins ever published before the war, called Brass Bounder, which I'd read. His brother was Samir Hepburn, the artist, the official war artist. And I went to the bridge when we set sail from Alexandria to Gapa and said, thank you very much for taking us, sir. You don't want us to keep watch, do you? He said, yes, I bloody well do. I thought, oh, God, you're one of those. So, I said, we don't know anything about the Merchant Navy. He said, now's your chance to learn. And that was it. And we had to keep watch. The convoy was attacked immediately we left. One ship was sunk within 12 hours.
Where was that?
In the Med, coming back to Alexandria. But we got the rest of the way home, landed at, and of course, immediately I was appointed to a destroyer when I got back.
And you landed where?
Liverpool.
Yes. And where did you join your destroyer?
I went down to Bedford where I was staying on leave, and they told me to... I can hardly tell you, I'm so ashamed. Telegram arrived saying, report to HMS Impulsive at Scarborough. Now, I should have known it was Scarborough. And like a fool, they sent me a railway warrant to Scarborough, and I got on a train from Bedford to Scarborough. I mean, I changed several times. I got to Scarborough at midnight, and there was an RTO, a rail transport officer there, a sergeant, I think. Every station in the war had a rail transport officer of sorts there to help service people, idiots like myself. And I said, I've come to join Impulsive. Is she in the hall? He said, never heard of us. I said, are you sure? He said, there are no ships here at all. So I got a phone in his office. I phoned the duty officer at midnight in Admiralty. There's always a duty officer. And he said, well, that's funny. He said, let me go and see, look at the signal. He said, that's right, you've done right. But he said, I'll ring you back in 10 minutes. He said, very sorry indeed. You should have been Scarpa. So I said, what do I do? He said, go back to Bedford. We'll send you another signal there. As a result of that, I arrived in Scarpa eventually about 4 days late, by which time Impulsive had sailed for Russia. So I spent nearly 2 weeks in the depot ship there, and it was an ex-castle. I think she was called Dunluce Castle, and it was made into a sort of hotel for people arriving like myself. Only one person in the wardroom, that was a dentist. And so after breakfast, he said, come along to the surgery, I'll have a look at your teeth. And so I went along to him, and he said, now you've got very good teeth. But he said, what I like to do is one tooth a day, I will drill everything out and fill them. He said, it'll last you forever. And I haven't lost a tooth yet. One lost there, all the rest are mine. And we had nothing else to do but to talk, and we talked. And at the end of it all, I thanked him very much. I joined Impulsive. Years later, I had toothache in Bournemouth one day, and I rushed into a very plushy dentist and said, look, I'm going to India tomorrow, can you do it? And he opened, he said, who the hell did your teeth? And I told him at this time, he said, oh my God. He said, you know, he's one of the royal dentists. I said, well, he was in the Navy. He said, that's right. He said, look, all these books here are written by him. He said, he's a genius. Amazing. Yes. So he said that he's one of the ones the royalty can call upon. He mended my tooth and I went to India, but that was a long time later.
Strange. Did it hurt to have all your teeth drilled out?
No, I didn't trust him, but it worked.
Yeah.
And he filled every all the back teeth,
yeah,
not the front.
Yeah.
And they lasted forever. Mm. Well, they will do.
Yeah, excellent.
So, how much longer have we got on this one?
Right, 10 minutes.
10 minutes. So there we are. I had done my time in combined operations, and I was now appointed to Impulsive. She's a fleet destroyer. She wasn't at Scarborough. She was up in Russia by the time I got there. And she came back and I joined immediately.
And you were still a sub-lieutenant?
I was still a sub-lieutenant. Mm-hmm. I found I was the navigator and I was the signals officer.
Mm-hmm.
And this is when I really started to enjoy my war. It was wonderful. The ships.
What about the complement, the officers and so on?
There were 165 personnel on board, including officers. And we had a captain, a lieutenant commander in command, because it was a private warship. You see, in a flotilla of destroyers, usually eight. One is the senior one, and he's a foreign captain. He's called Captain D for destroyers, usually known as D. He has a half leader, which is a commander, three stripes, and all the rest are known as private ships, and they are lieutenant commanders. And this was a private ship, and we had Lieutenant Commander Philip Bekem, B-E-K-E-N-N. First lieutenant was a very, very good, I think his name was Wilson. He only lasted 3 weeks. He was a brilliant RNVR officer, and he was, I'd been there about 3 weeks, he disappeared, and he got a command of a small ship himself, and a new lieutenant, first lieutenant was appointed, a man called Slamek, who was the son of a vicar who lived in North Dorset. He was about 6'1", which was unusual in those days, 6 foot. He was very thin, pipe-smoking misogynist. Absolutely the wrong person to have as a first lieutenant. He had nothing to say. He had no interest in anybody or anything except pipe smoking and being a misogynist. And he was tame. He wasn't, I mean, I never had a cross word with him or for him, but he was just negative. That was the two senior ones. Then we had four watchkeepers. The senior watchkeeper was David Lacey, who was an Oxford graduate, peacetime RNVR. Very experienced, should have been the first lieutenant, brilliant man. I was going to tell you about his funeral. He was last of the war, David Lacey, and then one day when I was in Sheffield in about 25 years ago, 24 years ago, I saw his, a Lacey died in the Telegraph, and I felt quite sure it was him because of the name of his wife, whatever it was. And I wrote her on the off chance saying how sorry I was, and I got the wrong day, saying I'm very sorry. She wrote back immediately, said how wonderful to hear. She remembered, she was a Wren officer up in Scarborough. And she said, something I mentioned, she said, I didn't know anything about what you told me about David. Could you elaborate and send some photographs, which I did. And I wrote a long letter saying what a brilliant officer he was. I said I was RN, but I learned more from him than any RN officer in my service. So she asked me to go to the commemorative service, which was about 3 months later. I went down, I drove from Sheffield, got down to their house, beautiful house, a large house in Oxfordshire in a village, on the village green. 10 minutes late, so I rushed to the church, which was the other side of the green. And I was ushered into the front, right in the front. I sat down. No one knew me. I could go to sleep. And suddenly I was sort of woken up by familiar words, and it was Lord Montgomery, not his son, who was Lord Montgomery. And he was doing the address, or whatever you call it. And I thought, God, he's reading my letter. And what he did was, he read the letter that I'd written with all this about. So he said, that I'm reading this because there's only one of us here in the church who knows an entirely different David. He said, none of us have had any experience of him at all in wartime. Mm-hmm. And he said, this is a magical letter and I must read it. And of course, I'd missed all that. And suddenly it was the words of my letter that woke me up. Afterwards, he said, I do apologize for this. I didn't have a chance. You were a bit late. And I said, I know. I'm never late for anything, but I was today, the traffic. We had a long talk about it, and they asked me if I'd stay the night down there in their house. I didn't. I stayed for supper, and then we walked around and talked with his sweet wife. My gosh, she was out. She was in signals, in the communications officer in Scarborough. Tiny little Wren. Mm. Sweet little thing. How he ever met her, I don't know. But
yes.
That was it.
So he was someone you learnt a lot from.
A lot. He
Do you
was
remember any other personalities on board?
Yes, so that's that. Three more watchkeepers, myself, Australian called Ian Howard from Melbourne, and an RNR sub-lieutenant called Mac, McNeil, Ian McNeil, I think it was. Ian, we always called him Mac. The doctor was a tall Irish doctor, lugubrious character, brilliant doctor from Belfast called Thompson. The engineer was a commissioned warrant officer. He'd now got two stripes. One of these poor unfortunates who always bore a grudge because I was equivalent rank with him at the age of 21 and he was 44 or what it was, and only just, you know, this always niggled him, I know, but nice little, and his name was Brading, B-R-A-D-I-N-G, the only man I've ever met in my life who made his children give presents to their mother on their birthday. He said, she did all the work, you've done damn all, so they gave mother presents on her birthday. Quite unique. And one other officer, the Gunner T, that was a warrant officer. Every destroyer had a gunner with a very thin stripe, a T for torpedoes, and he was the sort of torpedo officer.
Okay. Derek Plummer, end of reel 6.